This is the podcast for Tuesday, January 31st, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. And we've just finished watching the movie Immortality on Ice, which is posted separately. And this is our discussion, which follows on Cryonics. Okay, so what are your thoughts? Here's a little gag. Jeff and Akbar. Jeff and Akbar's Cryonics pet. You see, do you sincerely want to live forever at a price you can afford? Then bring your head down to Jeff and Akbar and Jeff's Cryonics Hut. Air conditioned, and it's cool inside. And go down here. And it says, not a sci-fi pipe dream, but an actual business venture. Do you smell something funny? I better check the thermostat. Dinner is served. Just kidding. Yes, we have party ice. And you can shop and compare. And you have method of after-death care, burial. Bodily tissue results, decaying, wormy. Chances of resuscitation, slim to none. Reanimation, dry and dusty. Chances of resuscitation, none. Burial at sea, bloated and wormy. Chunks missing, none. Frozen in a jar, looking good, chances of resuscitation, quite likely. And again, living again is the best revenge, and here before and after. Welcome to the future, X3957, US $3 billion in storage fees. Okay, so. But in all seriousness, what did you guys think about the what do you guys think about the idea of cracks? I had a couple of comments during the break. Maybe if people would just make sure to speak loud enough that you're picked up on the recording if you'd like to sound off. Let me just check my mic here and make sure we're coming in strong for the audio. Okay. What do you think? Who here would sign up or is interested in signing up? You wouldn't?
Yeah.
Not one? Nobody?
No.
So, what's your name again in the plaid?
Josh.
So Josh said, can you repeat what your initial reaction was?
What would really drive a person to choose to do this? I mean, yeah, you're banking on the future, but wait, was that what I asked? Was that the comment?
Yeah, I think you said something about like somebody having issues or like having unfinished business or something that a person might, you're sort of implying that a person might be mentally imbalanced if they were like really into this.
So you'd have to be banging on them actually finding immortality. Because what if you come back, it's 300 years in the future, and then you get hit by a car, and you walk out of the place?
Well, what if you get hit by a car when you leave this classroom?
That's true, but I mean, you're spending all that money to go meet cryogenically frozen, but you're hoping that in the time you're down, they find immortality.
Or just maybe a longer life.
Well,
yeah.
Well, technically, when you go under, I mean, when you die, I guess, your sense of time ceases to exist, so if they wake you up, wouldn't it seem instantaneous? So I don't really think it would matter. I feel like you just go to sleep and kind of wake back up, especially. And if not, then just not. I mean, That's what will happen.
So what's the alternative? Be buried in a pine box?
Essentially, I mean, some people are just so afraid of dying, afraid of, you know, whatever happens next, regardless of whether we're going to figure that out, or you just get to find out when you die. And there's just so many things wrong with cryonics or cryogenics and whatnot. I mean, it's such an incredible pipe dream. I mean, say, supposedly, if we invent technology within the next several decades, if not centuries, in order to revive people, you know, how are they going to pay for it? How are they going to, you know, basically restart their lives once they, you know, get reanimated? What kind of psychological fallout happens? You know, it's centuries since all of your friends, your family, your loved ones, everything that's familiar to you has been left in the past. So regardless of whether you wake up and you get to experience life again, the incredible amount of hardship, if not the fact that society and culture in general has probably just forgotten about you and left you behind. You were part of the singularity event that happened centuries ago. Technology and society and culture in general will advance to a certain point where, you know, it's like I read this article yesterday about would it be right to clone and reanimate, not reanimate, but to clone and bring a Neanderthal back. We managed to get its DNA and have the proper technology to do that. But is it really fair to the people freezing themselves? Is it fair to, you know, just bring them back without anything? I mean, they're basically just an experiment.
Well,
and that's not
what if you're volunteering for the experiment, though?
What's that?
What if you're volunteering for the experiment? I mean, all the people who've been frozen so far, they want to be frozen.
Mm-hmm.
They pay good money for it. for service, and a shot at immortality. And they say, look, one of the guys, Steve Bridges, talked about this. He says, the chronics is sort of a grand experiment, and we don't know the results. And so the only question is, do you want to be in the control group, or do you want to be in the experimental group? So anybody who's like a science background or taking a science class, what's the difference between the control group and the experimental group? Yeah.
Well, the control group is the one that you basically let go on its normal path.
Mm-hmm.
The other group is the one that you introduce whatever condition or whatever stimulus or whatever, just a third-party effect. That you're trying to test or just produce something about it.
Say, it's 2250 AD or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then you have the control group. Yep, still dead. And the experimental group. Let me
spell this out.
The experimental group. The question mark. And it's some probability. And you'll notice the people in the spot. They place different degrees of probability for it. Like there's that cryobiologist who said, the outlook for frogs coming back this spring, you know, is pretty good. Outlook for human beings is much more guarded. And this is a big problem with the fact that the frogs are, they're an example. And frogs and insects and worms freeze every year, and they come back to life as if by magic every year. And so the idea is that here's a model that we want to replicate. Now, one of the problems is that over millions of years of evolution, these organisms have developed systems which allow them to freeze and come back to life. And so what we're trying to do is replicate that in a human being. Again, I go back to like the first attempts at flight, right? So people looked at birds and they said, hey, I'd like to fly through the air like a bird, right? And so you have, you know, people with these sort of hang glider deals. You have people that try to have like wings that flap up and down, and the whole thing, you know, crashes, right? But eventually people figure it out. Okay, here's how these birds do it. Here's how lift works. Here's how you glide. Here's, you can't get propulsion, be really hard to get with sort of flapping, but maybe if we can like find some way to get propulsion some otherwise, like with a propeller, and they figure it out. How to have artificial flight, you know, using the principles abstracted from natural flight, from natural organisms. And the idea is by studying frogs, they figured out, oh, how do these frogs keep the ice crystals from damaging themselves? Anybody remember that? Yeah, so there's
glycol inhibits the formation of ice within the body's cellular walls and whatnot. And also inhibits ice from actually becoming sharp, so it's like pierced most of the cell membranes.
Are you guys in any conversation over there? It's been distracting, so if you want to share something, share with the whole group, please. Cryoprotectants?
Sure.
And so these are like sugar. They're sort of like, non-toxic antifreeze. And it mimics the sugars secreted, you know, by frogs and rounds the ice crystals so they don't puncture the cells. So what happens with when you have a bunch of cells, the ice crystals come in, they puncture the cell, and then the content leaks out. And that's not good, right? So what happens if you use these cryoprotectants, the ice crystals are much more round, and they're not going to puncture the cells, and they kind of move around, and you're okay. And you do have to go past the ice point, and you actually have to get down to the temperature of liquid nitrogen, and once you get to the ice point, I mean, all the damage that's done is going to be done, and nothing else is going to happen. And then between, 32 degrees Fahrenheit and the temperature of liquid nitrogen, nothing really is going to happen there. But the thing is, once you get to the ice point, there's all these things going to happen. You have to cool evenly, you got to watch out for the ice crystals, and you're hoping you're not damaging your brain so much that you're not going to be able to bring it back and have it function again. Look at the rat, right? Or the hamster, whatever they had, the gerbil, I can't remember what it was. Was he a hamster? Oh, hamster, okay. So the hamster, he was completely frozen. Now, did he die at the end of the experiment? Yes. But was he able to live, for a couple hours on a respirator? Yes. These are like the early attempts. So it didn't go, stunningly, but they're just, trying to figure this stuff out. And his heart was beating, and he was alive for a couple hours before he had, catastrophic failure from the ice damage. So let me come back to a couple of these. So one on the scientific feasibility, I don't know which one we want to hit first. People mention a lot of different things.
It's kind of like the head. I mean, you never know if, at some point in the future, maybe science will have some kind of, cell reformation thing that could possibly, rebuild their entire body or something. Like, we don't know that now.
So right now we have a couple of things. In the future, right now we can... write some of the things up here. Endless phones. we can do this with frogs now. So what they do is they clone a frog, they get some DNA from the frog, they make a genetic duplicate of the frog, they grow it in a lab, and it grows into an adult frog, which is just like the previous frog, except for it doesn't have a head. It's basically got, and I think maybe it's got, it doesn't have like the higher brain, the frog's brains aren't all that. But the idea is it's sort of, you grow a human being back, and you grow it with just the brain stem that controls the autonomic nervous system, but not with the cerebral cortex and the more advanced parts that most scientists think are the seat of consciousness. So you grow a clone of yourself without the head, without the higher brain functions, and then you take your brain and then or your whole head maybe, and stick it onto the body. And who knows how this stuff's going to work in the particulars in the future. But at least there's proof and concept, right? If you can grow a genetic duplicate of your body and you can attach the brain to the brain stem, then you're going to be good as new. And then there's other things like stem cells where you can repair damage. You have stem cells or these undifferentiated cells that you can use to repair damage of tissues. There's no rejection problems because they have your own DNA. And then there's also nanotechnology, which is just starting to get off the ground too, very important. They mentioned Eric Drexler, I think. Wrote this book, Engines of Creation. And it's about nano. They said, these bots are theoretical in nature, but the nanotechnology is, getting millions and millions of dollars in research grants. Right now they have carbon nanotubes and other things that are just starting to be put into practice. And so, but the idea of these nanotechnology is the idea of sort of microscopic robots, which will go around your body, find the damage, and repair it. And it's, you know, if you extrapolate out into the future, that's what we're going to have. And the one guy who's doing like the stuff with the bonds and the computer, that's, you know, it's a 1996 computer, and he talks about how right now, if you want to make something, what you do is you find some big hunk of metal or ceramic or whatever, and you pour it into a mold or you shape it with a machine. And he says it's sort of like trying to make something with Lego with boxing gloves on. And he says in the future, we'll take off the boxing gloves and then we'll be able to, you know, manipulate the atoms and molecules the way we want to. Right now, the best we can do is arrange a bunch of atoms on a flat surface to spell IBM. So IBM took, you know, a bunch of xenon atoms and arranged it to spell out their company name. But in the future, we'll be able to not build things from the ground up. So instead of taking a big hunk of something and shaping it or pouring something into a mold, you take a bunch of atoms and you have a machine that's going to arrange them the way you want. So, and you can pretty much arrange them any way you want. And so you can have little tiny machines that sort of work like our white blood cells work, or our, I suppose, even the red blood cells. We have all these cells in our bodies that do certain things. We'll have little mechanical, you know, artificial machines that will go around in our body and do things like scavenge for garbage material and get rid of it, or come in and repair damaged cell walls and so on. So, did I miss anything of the cool technology that in the future is likely to make science more feasible? Okay. So what about the changing his mind about feasibility?
I wouldn't personally volunteer, but I mean, the possibility of it, I mean, can seem feasible.
So let me ask this. So when are you dead?
That's kind of the question that they're bringing up, because like, someone would generally say you're dead when your heart stops or when your brain shuts down, mm-hmm. clinically dead. But, you know, like towards the end of the video, people are saying, well, you're not dead if you come back later.
Right.
But, I mean, they're technically dead, but they're just hoping that they will be brought back to life at some point. So, but this raises the whole question of, you know, if you can be brought back, does that mean that your consciousness was still around?
Yeah.
Well, it also brings up the question of, like, is there somewhere in the brain or in the higher functions of the body and whatnot where the consciousness or the sense of self or identity and whatnot is actually, like, hardwired in? So that way when you go to sleep, that's why you wake up and you remember who you are. Or mm-hmm. if you're in a coma for a short period of time without too much brain damage, you wake up and remember who you are, or particularly, like, you know, what traits made you you.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's still research going into part of where, you know, where the brainstem is, where potentially the mind might be actually hardwired in, but I haven't read anything conclusive. So.
Most of the stuff I've read, it says like that your medulla oblongata, mm-hmm. it just deals with like the fight or flight response, sort of base survival emotions, maybe some sort of reproductive urges. Makes your heart beat, makes your lungs take in air, and that all the higher functionings of consciousness are happening in the cerebral cortex and the frontal lobes, and not the sort of back bottom part of the brain. You know, if that turns out not to be the case, maybe you just need to cut a little lower or something.
It's in newer studies, so I've had the chance to actually research them a lot.
But this point about when are you dead, like that kid at the beginning, that they showed, he fell into a frozen lake, right? And people ice skate, or just while you're walking around, you're walking in the snow, and you don't realize you're on a frozen lake. You fall in, you go into the ice, and then you're like floating around there. Rescue guys come in their scuba gear, they pull you out, put you in the ambulance, they take you to the hospital, and then they gradually warm your body, and then eventually, when you're warm enough, they'll start your heart. And then they get the, and then if they do it in the right way, you're good to go. You're alive again, even though you've been dead for like 3 hours. And under very cold conditions, you can be dead for 3 hours and come back. So that, you know, one question the chronicist asks is like, what's the difference between, you know, 3 hours and 300 years? If that's how long it takes, it's, you know, you're still dead. And, but are you really dead? And Edinger, the founder of Cryonics, that's the one name I'd like you to know from that video. Robert Edinger, he's the father of Cryonics. And he says, you're dead when you're never revived. So whether you're dead now does not depend on your state now, but it depends on your state in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, unless you think, again, going back to like that clip from the Mike Douglas show with that Milton Berle thing, you know, there was that interchange between those two guys, and the one guy said, oh, I never signed up for it, and Milton Berle said, I would. Turns out he didn't, but he's dead now, so he's in the control group. But he's like, and then the other guy says, well, don't you think there's something more up there? And he's like, no, maybe some little joke that I got up there, but there's nothing, you know. That's, he thinks this is it, and life is good, and why wouldn't I want to live it some more? So one of the reasons why people seem sort of hesitant about this is that they think, well, you know, there's a better life waiting for me, and so this is sort of going to be like a, what, like it's going to be a 300-year delay until I get my heavenly reward or something like that. But assume just for a minute that there isn't that, then what? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, it just it just keeps bringing you back to the ethical issue. I think that's probably a big decision maker for most people.
So what would be an ethical objection to Cryonics?
Playing God. I think it's kind of selfish in a sense. Like, nitrogen pollutes a lot. It takes a lot of energy to keep somebody frozen for 300 years. That's a lot of resources.
Well,
and in the future, there's going to be too many people.
Okay, let's just take one of these, the plain God thing. So what do you think about open heart surgery? Is that would you say there would be more problems with that? If like I need a quadruple bypass surgery or something?
Well, I mean, we're sorry.
Or somebody else would it?
I was just saying, I mean, we're constantly playing God with modern medicine. I mean, people, if we just like remove modern medicine entirely, then people would be dead way more often than they are. But with modern medicine, we're constantly bringing people back from otherwise naturally fatal circumstances. So it's kind of like this is just another, I don't know, example of how far we'd be taking it, I suppose. And I mean, this is a pretty extreme example of playing God, but we do it every day.
Think about Larry King, right? Rush Limbaugh used to refer to the show as not Larry King live, but Larry King alive. Because it's like he's still alive and he's still doing that talk show. He had a thing where he was like, this is in his early 60s and he had like a heart attack. And you know, he has a high stress job, he's on TV all the time, chain smoker. He would like smoke on his shows, one cigarette after the other, drinking coffee. He used to start out in late night radio, so he'd be up all night, you know, and just horrible lifestyle. And so he had this heart attack. And so afterwards, he had quadruple bypass surgery. He changed his diet. He stopped smoking, and then and reduced his stress. He married a wife who was like 30 years younger than him, had a kid, right? And so he had like, you know, he's still kicking right now, and it's like 25 years of life, and I think he did another like 15 or 20 years of Larry King Live, and wrote a book, and did all this stuff, and if not for his bypass surgery when he was in his early 60s, he'd be dead today. So with that, would you say it was selfish for him to get that surgery? Think of all the resources he was sucking up. You know, open heart surgery takes a lot of, you know, it's an expensive thing to do, right?
I think like the vast majority of people would agree, like, if the medicine is available to prolong life, I think a lot of people probably prefer to use the medicine to prolong life. So, I mean, I wouldn't think like it would be selfish per se, because I mean like vast majority of society would want that done to a loved one or friend or family or something.
Yeah, the selfish if you know granny wants chemo, even though she's going to live, probably only live 5 more years. It's going to be really expensive.
It's just very poor. It's all relative.
That's not my shoes.
Well, if it's all relative, then there's no such thing as selfish or unselfish, right?
You make it Christmas.
If value judgments are meaningless. But there is this idea that it's sort of the selfish. It's like, what's so special about you that you think you should live forever?
Yeah. To a certain extent, if you're spending your own resources, I can understand, like, you know, I've got $28,000 and I don't have any kids. Like, I'm going to go stick myself in the breed. That I can understand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you have a family and whatnot to support, I don't know, there's this kind of gray area between, like, is it selfish of you to want to preserve your life, or is it selfish of selfish because you're not providing for your family with the resources they could actually use, and this is an untested technology.
Sure.
This is an unproven technology.
Well, I mean, if you have life insurance, just buy a little more life insurance to the family and take care of you. This is how this is usually funded. So it's funded by typically by life insurance, or people have a little nest egg. Yeah.
So you can take out an extra life insurance policy, and then after, you can guarantee that money will be used for the cryogenics before you're dead?
Right, you're saying the cryogenics organization is your beneficiary.
Oh, okay. Right?
You know, what's going to happen in the future is the insurance company, if they're still around, are they going to come back to collect saying you're not really dead? You know?
Don't do it too early.
I think they've been doing it for a while, so... So there are certain companies that will work with cryogenics organizations, and there's probably a writer there that defines death as clinical death and so on, just to avoid that. So they have smart lawyers at the cryogenics organization. Yeah.
My question is, so say, you know, like 100 years, 200 years down the road, they actually figure out how to make this work. So the obvious assumption is that it's going to be way more expensive than to, like, actually the tools and the time and et cetera, and just with, you know, how the economy goes, to revive people than it is, right, like, what they're projecting right now. So then what happens to that person when they wake up? They're like, well, yo, it's, like, you know, $8 billion. And they're like, what?
Well, would you rather be
dead or
and free of debt, or would you rather be alive and in debt?
Huh, yeah, I guess it's a personal question.
I mean, what I would say, what you should do is sock away some resources and, you know, have enough for your suspension, and then put some of the other money in, like, a living trust, and or some kind of a trust, like, you know, the Nobel Prize. Stop talking to me, please. It's distracting. Does anybody know about the Nobel Prize, how the Nobel Prize is funded? So this guy, Alfred Nobel, he invented dynamite. It was used in World War II and a lot of other wars, and people's limbs were blown off and, you know, just turned this carnage, and he felt really guilty about it. So he says, okay, what I'll do is I'll put all my money in a trust fund which will last forever, and it'll just keep on collecting interest, and in the meantime, there'll be a payout every year to people who do the most for world peace, who do the most for science, who do the most for literature. And so you have the Nobel Prizes for peace and literature and science.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah, so you could have, you know, a trust fund, which would be, you know, the Barbiel future life as a multi-billionaire trust fund, right? And maybe give out a little bit, you know, to good worthy cause every year. But mostly you want to just let that principle grow and grow and grow. And think about 300 years of compound interest or whatever it is. I mean, that's going to be a lot of money. And even if it's just a little bit to start with, that money, you know, it grows like crazy, particularly in the later years. So I mean, anybody who's going to be frozen today, who even puts away a little in just some very conservative investments, is going to come back as like the Bill Gates of the future.
If our economy lasts 300 years.
Well, I suppose, you know, there's no such thing as a sure thing, right? So there could be, you know, the bolide hits the, you know, the big meteor hits the Earth and decimates us. There could be like you know, superbug, germ warfare, biological warfare agent gets out and wipes out the human race, zombie apocalypse, nuclear war, right? You just kind of go down. So I mean, global warming, what, you know, what there's all sorts of science fiction scenarios, some of which are more likely than others. So then, but you know, you pay your money and take your choice, right? What, again, what's the alternative? What's your chance of coming back if we drop you into a pond box, right? Or bury you at sea? You're going to be, you know, for food for the worms. So what about this? What about this idea that only, you know, certain people are going to be the people who sign up, those who choose to do it, they're the one, if this works, will be the only people coming back. And they're going to be richer than, you know, Bill Gates. Is that morally problematic?
Yes.
Oh, why is that?
You're straining out people that have the money. I'm not going to limit it all the people with the money to people with low values, but if that is the case in a lot of those situations, if we're preserving low values for the future.
Well, what do you mean by we, though?
Well, people that are preserving themselves.
Yeah, so you just want those people to die or something?
Opening up the...
But the thing is, like, you're gonna come back and you're gonna be frozen essentially in the state. Like, I mean, if you think about like old people with rotten cancer too, man. If you're at liquid nitrogen levels, literally nothing's gonna happen to you. You're not gonna decay. It's not like meat in the freezer. Like, you should only keep meat in your freezer. Well, first of all, you shouldn't eat meat. But if you do eat meat and you keep it in the freezer, you should only keep it in there about 6 months, because after that, it's gonna start to decay. Maybe 9 months if you keep it at like your freezer really, a really low temperature. But, you know, if it's in there for more than a year, then you're gonna get some cellular decay. At the temperature of liquid nitrogen, you're not gonna get any cellular decay. So it's gonna be basically like when, you know, you're in the hospital bed and, you know, you breathe your last breath and then you die, and then, you know, they warm your body up and you're back essentially the same way you were in the hospital bed, you know, maybe minus some damage from freezing. And again, depending on how early they get you, ideally you're in the hospital bed, right? You don't die in a street corner someplace. That would be bad. And so if you die in a hospital bed, they're able to freeze you right away, medevac you to the cryonics facility, you're going to be in good shape. If you die in a sticky July weekend and they don't find you till Monday, your chances are basically the same as getting a pine box.
What kind of meant not literally rotten, like they're, I mean, if they were selfish for their reasoning to want to come back later, and if they're somebody that was not really a valued part of society, you know, if they were some corrupt lawyer that took advantage of everybody to get the money to be able to preserve himself, and he's kind of metaphorically a rotten, you know, person. So what I mean is, if I don't believe it's selfish in all cases, but let's say it is, you know, are they going to be valuable later on?
I don't know, maybe we should just kill all the selfish people now instead of, like, only killing the ones that opt for cryonics. It seems like if you think selfish people should die, then, you know, it seems like you're inconsistent and be for killing all selfish people, not just the ones that don't exist.
Give them a value test before they have to pass it, before they be frozen.
So you think the government should decide, like, whether you live or die based on how valuable you are to society?
No, not to them.
That just sounds like an awful... I mean, that sounds morally problematic to me. I don't want some bureaucrat deciding about how much worth I have. Good hell. I'm my own man. I have my own inherent worth. And it seems like if it's, you know, my choice, it's my money, it's my body, and I make this very wise choice and end up, you know, risking my capital and then winning big. And, you know, in the meantime, my capital is not just sitting there, you know, buried in somebody's backyard. It's, you know, helping to grow companies and provide jobs and so on. And then it grows into something really big when I come back. It seems like I should be able to enjoy the fruits of my labor and, you know, get my angular body and my implants and, you know, enjoy the light life and future, and you know, maybe shed a tear for all the people who weren't smart enough to make the same choice I made. Because you look at the number of people that make the choice for cryonics, it's really small. So it's let me put this up here. It's small, I'll even say sort of fringe movement right now. Once the first person comes back, it's going to balloon up, right? It's sort of like, you know, if you're buying gold, right? You know, when gold's sitting there at $300 an ounce, nobody's buying it. Pretty soon it starts getting bid up to, you know, 1,000 over, and pretty soon everybody jumps on the bandwagon. But by then, you know, that it's only going up, it's not going up as much. So it's the same thing. It's a small fringe movement right now. But once the first person comes back, I think it's probably going to be routine that, like, if somebody dies at the scene of an accident, they're going to have, like, little cryopods to pop them into to get them to the hospital. And if they're, like, just totally screwed up and they're dead on arrival, they're going to, like, go in the storage vault to fix later if their technology isn't around to bring them back. Or, you know, maybe if they have to do a really complicated operation, they might have the person sit there for a month. Or, you know, if it's in Canada, you just got to wait, right? So might be a year or two. Yeah.
What on earth does this mean for our population growth?
Yeah.
Like, if no one ever really dies, like, holy cow. That's, well, there's so many people already.
Most modern first world nations have negative population growth apart from immigration. So what's happening right now in the United States, we have a positive population growth. But it's because we have, like, you know, about, you know, a million and a half immigrants coming in from Mexico and South America, primarily, and the other countries too. If we didn't have any immigration in the United States, our population growth would actually be dropping. And so what's going to happen once the whole world gets to, you know, close to first world status? You look at the third world, what happens is that when people realize that they can have, like, an investment nest egg to take care of themselves in their old age, they don't need children to work on subsistence agriculture in the family farm, or they don't have to worry about half their kids dying, you know, before they reach the age of five, then what they do is they end up, like, having fewer kids. And some people end up having no kids. Like that family on there, like that woman said, I feel like we're just an average family. We have like eight kids and something, like, you know. I think they're in Arizona, weren't they? There's a lot of Mormons in Arizona, so that might be part of the sort of culture there. But yeah, that's a lot. But what happens, they're pretty unusual, right? Most people, like my parents had three kids. I'm not planning on having kids. And I know I have lots of friends that don't have any kids and have no plans for them, or they have like one or two. And that's typically what happens, is you end up with people and they have all sorts of consumer goods, all sorts of interesting things to do. They don't have to worry about somebody to take care of them in their own age. And they say, I don't know if I really need kids or not. And so you have birth rates dropping, actually. And really, overpopulation is only a problem it's a localized problem in the third world, where the, and this is talked about in the readings too, overpopulation is a localized problem where the reproduction rate is high. And technology is low. You know, places like Bangladesh or even China. China's just got so many people in it that it's, you know, it's difficult to feed the populace. But also, they're a backward communist country, and have been, you know, since the 40s. And so they have, you know, they're just starting now. They've embraced a sort of moderate form of capitalism. And who knows, you know, they may be more capitalist than the United States given the current trends. But they just have all sorts of, you know, problems, and they're just now getting modern technology. But you look at the United States or Western Europe, they have a long history of you know, free enterprise and capitalism. Even if they've gone a little socialist in the last few decades, they've got all this history of, you know, free production, they have a high technological society, and the birth rates there are small. It also goes along with secularization too. The more secular you get, the less interested people are in having kids. And trends, again, are that society is getting more and more secular. Belief in God and religious affiliation are both going down each year. So, in Western industrialized countries, and as the rest of the world moves into, you know, second world and first world status, these trends will probably continue, and the birth rates are going to drop anyway. And, you know, when people are living, you know, 100, 200, 300 years, people aren't going to be reproducing as much either. I know, thoughts?
If you compare, ideological beliefs, more spiritual compared to the material one, it's kind of interesting that you can criticize, like, the biological argument, like, oh, I'm going to preserve my physical body so I can have a life sometime in a certain point in the future, as opposed to the spiritual kind of belief, like, oh, well, if I were to leave my body now, then it's just, all skies from there or something. So it's kind of interesting that, like, this can have so much of an uproar, not uproar, but just a lot of argument against it, I was kind of thinking earlier, like, you're dead and you're never revived.
Right.
But this kind of thing, like, well, what about the, like, I know Hindu people are just, Buddhists were just like, the whole reality thing is just not, like, like physical sort of stuff, so, I don't know.
So this goes back to this idea that there's a spiritual world, that maybe this is a huge, complete waste of time, or maybe a waste of resources or something. And you might actually get cases where you have the people that think you're playing God and don't like it, you know, storming in the castle, right? They show that scene from Frankenstein where they say, always with the mad scientist, you know, who tries to understand the secret of life, always with disturbing results. And they show the guys, you know, with their pitchforks and torches and rakes that are going to come and storm the castle and kill the monster. And so you might have people that might religious fanatics storming crime facilities in the future. So that's something you have to keep in mind too. Particularly if there's some huge economic downturn or something like that, and people are looking for a scapegoat. I have other thoughts, objections, support? Yeah.
I wonder what the implications would be towards natural selection if there's so many people that catches on and it's really common to do that. Because I wonder how that would affect the next stage of our development.
I think the smart people are the ones that will probably survive, like the people that sign up, the people that bet on technology, the people that bet on their, suppose you think about it this way, the people that bet on their immortal souls, going to heaven, suppose they're wrong, right? So what happens is the people who, are basically naturalists, or don't believe in the spiritual world, you get more of them probably. Because the people that believe in the spiritual world are, even if they're not 100% unlikely to do this, it seems that they're less likely to do it. Because they think there's something better, a spiritual world waiting for them. Whereas the materialist is going to say, no, this is my version of immortality. This is my own shot. So you might get a more secular society. I don't know, you'd necessarily get more conservative society. If you bring all these people back, first of all, again, it's a small fringe movement. I think at the time this video was done, there were like seven. I think there was 700 people frozen in the 90s, and then maybe like 1,000 more signed up. And those numbers have gone up a little bit, but not very much. I mean, really, really small. I mean, just go back to the Mormon thing. There's hundreds of times more Mormons and Scientologists, and think about sort of the movements, social movements and institutional movements. There's a lot more of all, think about any kind of type of person with a belief that seems kind of quirky, Jehovah's Witnesses. There's millions of those. There's only I'm not even sure there's 10,000 people in the crimes movement. It's pretty small. As far as people who've actually signed up. Other thoughts? Objections or supports? There's something we didn't cover here. Psychological adjustment. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
If we're still working on objection, I support cryonics. I'm never going to sign up for it, but it furthers the scientific progress towards cryonics, which we need. Expansion, any movement off of this one dust ball needs a stability. The people that sign up for this, go them. I'm donating my body to science when I die, which is the only reason I'm not going for cryonics, because my body can help future students and people learn medicine and everything like that. I don't want this thing when I'm dead. The cryonics people are doing the same thing. They're furthering the bounds of science and giving us a stable launching platform towards discovering how to freeze a human, keep them frozen, and revive them 20, 30, 50, 90 years later. After, as far as I'm concerned, because I really hope the human race survives towards a progress towards the next star, like Barnyard 22 or something like that, where they can go and be revived rather than having to do generational seed shifts.
That's a good point. Like, suspended animation could actually be something beneficial to come out of this kind of technology.
And these people are pioneering it. They're allowing the funding and the grants and the money to come in and paying to figure out how to do this to humans. I don't care that they're doing it when they're dead.
So interstellar travel. The funny thing that about interstellar travel is that you send like the cryonauts on the ship on autopilot to Alpha Centauri system or whatever, wherever you're going to go, where you think there's some planets. I don't know what the nearest system is, whether the planets, but you send it out there, right? What's going to happen is, you know, 200 years go by, and we've got, you know, warp drive or something that can hold space or whatever, and you just, like, you're going to, okay, oh, here's that silly ship they sent off, you know, 150 years ago when they didn't have faster-than-light travel.
They're going to reach their destination. They're going to find the civilization already exists. Yeah, we made it, guys. You showed up.
Right. Well, there's a probability of it not.
I might be
too fragile and too small of a basket to hinge all our bets on.
Right.
And the future of science, I applaud these people that are signing up for it. I just never will, because I frankly don't want to come out in the future. I'd rather figure out what's going on in this life, do my studies, get it done, and try and make a better place for now rather than die and wait to make a better place 400 years in the future.
Well, why can't you make a better place, make the world a better place now, and make it a better place in the future?
When I die, I just want to die. I'm done. This life is not worth prolonging 400 more years.
Really? So is it? Now, if your life was like, if you thought your life was really great, and it was like exciting.
I'm completely happy with my life, but I want to go 80 years and then stop.
Well, why don't you want more of a good thing? So this is sort of a psychological, or maybe it's like an existential objection.
What he just said, who wants to live forever? I don't want to live forever. I want to take my chances. I want to experience life in the fullest. And part of experiencing life is experiencing death.
Well, part of that can tie into the whole playing God and whatnot. Why some people are actually averse to this is like, you know, who wants to live forever? You know, maybe I want to go with the Hindu or Buddhist idea of going back on the wheel of life and being reincarnated if that does happen.
Do you believe there's like another life though? But you're not interested in this.
I have no clue. What I believe is we don't know until we die, and by then it's too late to tell anybody else.
Right. But you take like
as far
your
as my
life.
Personal belief is, I follow the Norse and deist way of living. I believe in a universal consciousness.
Okay, so you do think there's something else. I mean, you do think there's probably something else waiting for you, something better.
No, not necessarily better or worse. It could be just I die.
Here. So it's like, I love my life and I expect it to get better and better. And then when it's 80 years, that's enough. I've had that.
Yeah. But running out, painted in blue woad with a claymore at the first terrorist camp I could find and trying to kill him with a claymore and then die and go to Valhalla if that exists, or just die.
But I don't understand why, like, it's like, If I were just like to start handing out money, I'd say, here, it was like $10, and like, oh, what's the catch? And I'm like, no catch, I'm just handing out money today. And I gave you a $10 bill, and you're like, thanks. And I'm like, so do you want another 10? And you're like, nope, 10's fine, thanks. I don't really have any use for another $10. It seems like if it were me and someone was handing me money, they hand me the other 10, I'm like, okay, sure, I'll take another 10. And I just keep on having my hand out as many bills as they wanted to place, because I like money, and I can't see having too much money. I can't see having too much happiness or too much life. But why, how do you know how much is enough? I mean, Larry King, again, you know, a lot of people used to die at 62. That was considered a normal lifespan. And for people of Larry's generation, you know, dying at 62 of a heart attack was pretty typical. And people used to have an average lifespan of 30 when we were living in grass huts or out in the rainforest. And 30 years old was seen as sort of the average age. And people lived to maybe 60 and 70. And people still lived a long time, but they're pretty rare because usually somebody got bit by a snake or died of disease or killed by roving nomads or what have you. Whereas, you know, today, it's, you know, the limit right now is, anybody know what the limit is?
It's about 120 years. The Hayflick limit. That's maximum lifespan.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about this, though, is that, they're doing research into the aging process right now, and they're learning more and more about this, about how aging works. And aging isn't some sort of magical process. It's a series of interrelated processes which can be, you know, changed. And they've done experiments on worms and even on higher animals and showed that one of the ways that you can live longer is by eating less. Which is a tough thing to do. There are certain genetic markers that you find in people who are from long-lived families. And so if you can have gene therapy, you can, you know, push that out to 120 years. And then if you can really understand and unlock the aging mechanism and how it works, you know, there's no limit to how long you go. And you keep on planting in stem cells, rejuvenating old tissues. Again, as long as your brain is still functioning, there's no practical limit until, you know, you might run into things when you're talking about like millions of years in the future, like the heat death of the sun or the heat death or the sun going supernova or the heat death of the universe might be some things. But that's like way far out, plenty of time. So the other question is like, why wouldn't you want to go into the future? Yeah.
Well, the future already exists now, and that's one thing that, you know, I have the pipe dream of like, oh, I want to be in the future, because I'll be better in the future. I mentioned, the singularity event. It's basically a point in time where a civilization or society makes, you know, a technological leap, and say reading John Locke was actually really difficult for me, reading out of your book and whatnot. I was trying to shoot through to the flesh of what he was trying to get at, but just because the language he uses is dated.
Right.
At some point, after he wrote his paper and his discourses and whatnot, fast forward to the 21st century, there's a singularity event or several singularity events that separates our future, our particular moment in time, our epoch, from past generations.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons I am very leery of this technology actually working. I feel bad for these folks. I mean, I'm going to have to agree that it could potentially be beneficial for its research properties.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of, you know, imagining, you know, going into the future and everything being better, why not make tomorrow be better? Why not make, you know, the future that we have now, tomorrow, the next day, the next week, instead of several hundred years from now, that hypothetically it could get better?
Well, why is it even either or, though?
Very true.
Why can't I just make my life better and, you know, have some insurance that, hey, in case this works, I could, you know, have, you know, live in the future world and I'll have my flying car finally, and, you know.
Well, sorry, were you finished?
No, I just did.
Okay.
All the cool stuff in the future.
I think that it boils down to such a deeply personal notion of contentment with now and fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I mean, I think that a lot of it can be boiled back down to psychological adjustment and like what makes up what we have now, what we have in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I'm speaking from personal space, so this is just my opinion and my bias, but it's the experiences and the people that I have around me. It's not the material things, it's not my flying car, it's not, you know, the kind of house or whatever computer technology that I have. It's the, like, the real, the organic, the sensuous experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if I live, you know, my entire life until my 80s, 90s, or whatever it's going to be, and have my you know, live it to the most that I can and put everything in it, then I think that's where a lot of people will be completely fine, being like, I've done it, I'm happy, I'm content.
Okay, well, I think that's about all we have time for. So we'll talk more about Cranix on Thursday, maybe talk about what the chance of living forever as a spiritual being versus living forever in the material sense. And if you're going to bet on materialism or, you know, dualism or idealism, which where you're, where a betting man should place his bets. So we'll do that on Thursday. Jamila Kareem is going to be here tomorrow, Thursday, 4 o'clock, in the Center for Meaning and Learning. If anyone's interested, talking about the Nation of Islam, a racist class, gender, and Islam.